from experimental history. Shame them, shun them, ban them, beat them. Say what you will about the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, its 1936 constitution was a banger. It guaranteed freedom of speech, the press, assembly, and protest. It shortened the working day to 7 hours, affirmed the right to rest and leisure, and offered free education and free health care to all, including a wide network of health resorts for the working people. You gotta admit, this is a lot better than certain other constitutions that say count us, slaves as 3/5 of a person. It extended equal rights to all citizens, regardless of race or gender. In the 2 years after the constitution was adopted, however, Stalin purged something like 1 million people. 18 million Soviet citizens would be forced into gulag camps and colonies over the next 3 decades. We say that Stalin did all these things as if held the gun himself won, but obviously you can't run a gulag without guards, secretaries, accountants, engineers, architects, doctors, drivers, quartermasters, mid-level managers, kangaroo court judges, and all manner of flunkies, patsies, and stool page ons. This was all clearly in violation of Articles 103, 111, and 127, and many others besides. How could one of the greatest tragedies in human history happen when it was very explicitly not allowed? The uncomfortable answer is that a critical mass of people found prisons and purges palatable. Apparently, hundreds of thousands of regular people were willing to commit their own personal portion of an atrocity. The lesson here is obvious. Rules don't matter unless people act like they matter. Writing down laws does not endow them with physical force or psychic potency. We all know this. We all believe this. So why don't we act like it? Ever since the replication crisis began over a decade ago, most folks have agreed that the problem is the laxness of our rules, and that the solution is to tighten them. Vindicating this theory, a big group of researchers published a paper in 2023 showing that it's possible to achieve high rates of replicability, as long as you follow a set of rigor-enhancing practices. Confirmatory tests, large sample sizes, pre-registration, and methodological transparency. 1 year later, the paper was retracted because it failed to follow those rigor-enhancing practices. We should mandate replication, pre-registration, public data, bigger studies, and tiny Earth values. The more we can reduce researcher degrees of freedom, the thinking goes, the better our science will be. The journal editors claim the authors were not transparent about their methods, did not abide by their own pre-registration, and cherry pick the results that too clearly. We're not missing the right regulations. We're missing the right motivations. If you want to discover true things about the world, you'll be interested in the guidelines that help you do that, and you'll be thankful to the people who develop them. That's how the replication crisis could have played out. Someone demonstrates that our sample sizes are too small, and we all go, oh wow, we should make our sample sizes bigger because we want to know what's real and what's not. But if you're not actually seeking the truth, no amount of rigor-enhancing practices will ever cause you to find it. That's why our revolution in scientific regulation has mostly failed. We require researchers who conduct clinical trials to post the results on a public website, but only 45% of them do. We tell people to specify their primary outcomes beforehand, but if their studies don't work as planned, they just sneak in different analyses. One study on anesthesiology experiments found that 92% of them did this. We make researchers end their papers by saying data available on request, and then only 17% of them actually make their data available on request. 3. You can't turn a cheat into a scientist by making a rule against cheating. You think I don't take enough interest in your life, so let's make a rule. I have to ask you 3 things about your day before I start telling you about mine. The theory behind the let's make a rule fight is that we could live in harmony with one another if we could just compile all of our expectations into one big Google Doc. The most important rigor-enhancing practice is caring about getting things right, and without that, nothing else matters. Every couple will eventually have some version of the let's make a rule fight, where they try to solve some interpersonal issue through legislation. The let's make a rule fight never leads to a satisfying conclusion because nobody actually wants their partner to follow the rules. They want their partner to care. Being asked how was your day, dear, through gritted teeth because that's what our relationship handbook says to do is probably worse than not being asked at all. You want your partner to realize that your preferences are not silly affectations that can be belittled, ignored, or disputed until they go away, that they are, in fact, load-bearing parts of your personality, and to reject them is to reject you. In return, you have to realize that some of your preferences are more malleable than you thought, that maybe they don't all have to be foundational to your sense of self, and that some of them can be bent or jettisoned in the interests of coexistence. This is the work of love, and it takes a lifetime. You can't speedrun it by filling out a spreadsheet or signing a contract. The frictions of a lifelong relationship can be made intelligible, that is, understandable to the people involved, but they cannot be made legible, that is, understandable to everyone else. The best couples I know have all sorts of arrangements and accommodations that make zero sense to me but perfect sense to them, and that's exactly why they work well together. A successful relationship is nothing more than a package of haphazard remedies and rickety fixes that people would only ever devise and maintain when they really, really want to be together. Sometimes police officers break the rules, and the solution is obvious. We just need to police the police. If you strap a camera to every officer's chest and record everything they do, then they won't misbehave in the first place. And even if they do, we can discipline or fire them. This is the most foolproof plan of all time, supported by an unheard of 89% of Americans. Police departments all over the country agreed. Now every single large precinct has body cameras, and a majority of smaller precincts do too. The technology is out there and the data is in. How is our foolproof plan working out? Not well. According to a 2022 Department of Justice report, body cams might not have any meaningful effect on police behavior. One meta-analysis found a moderate drop in citizen complaints, but didn't find any difference on any other outcomes. Use of force, assaults against police officers, number of incident reports, etc. Another meta-analysis finds no evidence of downstream outcomes like conviction rates. The DOJ warns that we need more research, but this is enough to rule out gigantic effects. If body cams do anything at all, They probably don't do much. Maybe our plan just didn't go far enough. Bad cops can simply turn their cameras off or cause the footage to mysteriously go missing. Even if the video exists, it's only one version of events, and it's from the officer's point of view. Maybe what we really need is a swarm of drones to follow every police officer, recording every action from every angle, and they never shut off and their footage automatically gets uploaded to a public database. Or maybe we misdiagnosed the problem in the first place. We assumed that the justice system was eager to hold bad cops accountable, and that all it was missing was the necessary evidence. It turns out the justice system is actually rather ambivalent about holding bad cops accountable, and so it handles additional evidence as half-heartedly as it handled all of the evidence at A.